Yeah, it is humid as a ogre's nutsack.
Right. Yeah, and we might as well be recording on the sun, as Smash Mouth would say.
Ooh, would they?
Probably still, yes. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. With me again, here we are, Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
Yay, we still exist.
Yes.
With me, as always, is Cassidy Robinson from LA. And it's been a minute. It's been a couple weeks. Let's get into the damn thing.
The world has changed. The world, like the world from 2 weeks ago, has been a totally different world as we've lived. Now we've had like two or three communication directors for the White House. George Romero died.
Yeah, which is very sad. Martin Landau also died.
Yeah, super depressing.
We have so much movie news that we missed a bunch, so that's why you should follow along at Jabber and the Drone's Facebook page.
Yes, and or the Twitter, which I don't use as much. What I really wanted to talk about is you just had your anniversary. That's why we didn't have a show last week. You went to Palm Springs, did the anniversary thing.
Yeah, so, Jesus, it's been a while. So we went to Palm Springs over the weekend. That was really fun, and it was very hot. Mm-hmm. We didn't go and see a new movie, but I did rewatch Liar Liar on FX, which was a horrible cable edit, which they edited things out that you would not think they'd even need to edit out, and B, that movie did not age well.
Well, you know, I don't know. It's been a while. Since I've seen it. I'll take your word for it, though. And more importantly, well, I don't know about more importantly, but more importantly for this podcast, you and your wife, I'll include her, went to Comic-Con. Yes. As you usually do, which is almost kind of like your unofficial anniversary thing.
Sort of. Yeah, it was a different week. Sometimes it's a different week. But yeah, it's sort of like the kickoff of the festivities. Mm-hmm. Also, I had some cat drama during that time.
Okay.
This vaguely relates to Comic-Con, so I'll include this story.
All right, cat drama, here we go.
So, one of the days, Ashley wore a wig. She dressed up as Poison Ivy, and she wore a wig. Mm. And one of our cats, Blueberry, little calico cat, found her wig her hairnet that she used to pull her hair up for the wig and chewed on it, and it got stuck in her stomach, and we had to take her to the emergency room, and they had to do surgery to get it out of her.
Oh my.
So yeah, we also have a recovering cat from like full stomach removal surgery.
Jesus.
So it's been a busy couple weeks.
Sure.
Anyway.
How was Comic-Con?
Comic-Con, it was a weird year this year. It was a lot of fun. I actually felt like I got to do more this year than previous years. And, like, it wasn't as hard as normal. Like, I met the cast of the Defenders. I fist-bumped Luke Cage himself. Mm-hmm. That was awesome. And we were able to do that just because we had happened to cosplay as the Defenders. So that was really fun. The offsite events this year were killer. We got to do the Westworld offsite, which I don't know if you read about it.
I don't know what any of that means. I mean, I know Westworld's a show on HBO right now.
So Comic-Con's been focusing a lot more on these offsite events, which some of them you do still need a badge to do, but not all of them. So sometimes that can be kind of confusing. But they're like little pop-up museums or stores or whatever. This one in particular was a Westworld experience. And it was a lot of fun. It's like the most immersive pop-up event ever. Like they transport you to Westworld, basically. It's it's really fun.
You got to have like an actual like duel, like gun duel with a robot.
No, they didn't give you a gun, but you got to like hang out in the saloon, and they gave you some drinks, which is really cool. They gave you like a hat to walk away with.
That's fun.
Yeah, like a full on, like really good quality $150 cowboy hat,
which I'm sure you'll use all the time now.
You know, I've used it more than you'd think. but yeah. Anyway, so I do feel like though that there's way more bitching about Comic-Con this year than previous years as well. Like, I've seen a lot of snarky blog posts come up about just like how awful Comic-Con is, and and how like don't even waste your time. And so I wanted to address that a little bit as well. Like, fuck all of you. Like, if you're that miserable, like, you know, stop going. You know, it's not for everybody. I'll say that up top. It's, you know, there is some stuff that kind of sucks. Like, there are long lines and it is really crowded. And yes, they release the footage immediately in Hall H. I don't care. I still get to see it first and in a much cooler way than you got to on your computer. Someone I was with equated it to, and I really like this metaphor. It's like a rock concert, right? Like, sure, you've heard the live album, album. I said that weird. Album? You've heard the live album, you know, so you know what the songs sound like. You've heard them before, but that's not the same as being there. It's not the same as, you know, when they rock your face off with the 2-minute guitar solo you weren't expecting.
Okay.
And also, at least to Marvel's credit, even with their leaked footage, not everything they've shown has gone online yet. So even with the shitty bootleg footage, Marvel does hold it pretty close to the chest, and they actually respect that, you know, some of the stuff they're premiering is just for the fans, whereas like Warner Brothers literally will release it the moment the panel's over.
Right, right. I thought Marvel was like kind of divorced from the Comic-Con experience now because they're part of Disney, so they go to the D25 or whatever it's called.
D23. So they did skip 2 years ago. D23 is every other year. And they did skip a couple years ago when there was the last D23. So there was talks they might skip again this year. But they actually just showed the same Marvel Infinity War footage plus more footage. So they showed some of the same stuff at D23 this year, but we still got more at Comic-Con.
Marvel's big comeback at Comic-Con.
Oh,
the Marvel. Prodigal son has returned.
Well, they were there last year.
Okay.
They returned last year. I mean, I think the big thing is they just, that 1 year they didn't go, they were upset that, you know, everybody said Warner Brothers had the coolest panel, and they were like, no, no, that simply cannot be, because Marvel is way better than them every year.
Usually.
Anyway, so that's all I wanted to say, is like, all the people being snarky about Comic-Con, like, shut up. You're kind of biting the hand that feeds. Like, Comic-Con is sort of responsible for a lot of pop culture as it exists today. Not all of that is good, but for the most part. So, I don't know. I guess it just sort of has been irking me.
Okay. I mean, I will count that myself among some of that snark. I've said for a while I have no real need to go anymore. Mostly because I get my fix off of all the smaller cons without the big crowds. And the older I get, the less impressed I am by the panels. I don't really care about, like, seeing celebrities. That doesn't blow my mind anymore. So, and, like, you know, leaked footage, like, I know, yeah, it's not the same, but I, you know, we do the movie news, like, every week. Like, you know, just announcements don't, like, make me jizz anymore.
Sure, so, announcements are one thing, but, like, you know, an awesome trailer that's never been released before on these giant screens that are larger than IMAX screens.
Yeah.
You know, in a room full of 6,000 other fans losing their fucking shit.
Yeah,
It's cool. Like, it's a fun thing. I guess. You know?
When I go to cons, and I think even when I went to Comic-Con the first time in 2008 when it was San Diego, and it's probably smaller than WonderCon is today, mm-hmm. I'm more interested always in what's going on the floor. Because I feel like that's the beating heart of Comic-Con. That's like where that's where the retailers are talking to people and the deals are being made, and you can actually get your stuff signed, and you can actually meet people and see all the people dressed up. Like, to me, that's Comic-Con. The other stuff is just marketing and buzz.
To me, it's both. Like, all of it is Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there is something that separates Comic-Con from WonderCon, and I've been to Wizard World and stuff like that. And don't get me wrong, I love walking the floor. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite things to do. But it is the floor. It is the offsite events. It is the panels that are hard to get into, and they are. But that's another thing I want to speak to. Another complaint is like, oh, it's impossible to get into these panels. It's not impossible. You just have to have a plan. You have to commit to it. And part of that is what makes it worthwhile. I think that Hall H would be, like, way less cool if everybody could just, like, walk in. Like, the fact that you have to plan ahead and like, that's... It gives it Comic-Con sort of, like, a climax. Like, you know...
You would have been like if you had lived in like 1979, you would have been one of those Studio 54 brats who were like had to dress up in like the biggest, craziest feathered thing you could find just so that what's his face that Mike Myers played would let you in because you love the exclusivity.
I love events. fuck yeah, I would do that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's just a matter of, like, okay, if that's not what you're into, mm-hmm. that's fine. I guess, like any troll, stop being a fucking asshole about it, is my thing. Like, if you're not impressed by Comic-Con, cool, don't go. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that frees up tickets for people who do want to do all of these things.
Well, most of the complaints you're talking about, it comes from the press who go for free.
Yeah, right. Fuck them.
Generally speaking.
And they're a lot of the ones who ruin the experience for other people. But no, just in general, like I saw a lot of, like I'm a part of a Comic-Con Facebook group, you know, like on Twitter, just a lot of the fans were complaining, mm-hmm. Just about shit that happens every year. And
it was probably their first time or something. They just didn't know what they're getting into. And for all those people, I would just say, find your local con. You're going to have more fun.
For sure. For sure. And I think that is absolutely true. Like, I love San Diego Comic-Con because it is San
Complete
Diego
chaos.
Comic-Con.
Yeah.
But other cons are fun as well. So, you know, they're worth going to.
I recommend down here every year, I try and go to the Long Beach Comic-Con, which I think is really cool for where it is and how small it is.
Nice.
And it's kind of a best-kept secret so far. And Stanley's Kamikaze, which is growing exponentially every year, which now they're calling L.A. Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah. And well, that's because L.A. has for sure not gotten a chance because
they were going to do Comic-Con. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, actual Comic-Con just re-upped through like 2020 or 2021 or something. So they're going to be here for the foreseeable future. And the city is trying to expand the convention center, and they've made a lot of upgrades to the convention center this year too. So it's pretty safe to say Comic-Con's not going anywhere, like actual San Diego Comic-Con's not going anywhere anytime soon. But
For sure.
Yeah, but there's also a cool, pretty new con in Salt Lake that I think is going to be hitting its third or fourth year this year.
Mm-hmm.
There's New York Comic-Con.
There's a bunch. There's Seattle, the Emerald Comic-Con, the Rose City Comic-Con in Oregon. They're everywhere now.
On to the actual, like, programming for Comic-Con, because I did get into the illustrious Hall H this year. And I guess this is, like, Comic-Con movie news. I'm sure everybody's read blogs about it and
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to give you sort of my two cents. And then I was thinking, you know, just if you have or hadn't heard about any of this stuff, just kind of your thoughts on it.
Sure.
So the first thing of the day was Warner Brothers panel, which felt a little light this year. And I guess they actually had scheduled like an extra half hour, but the panel ended really early. So that was mm-hmm. kind of weird. They previewed Ready Player One, which Steven Spielberg was fucking there. Like, I was in the same room as Steven Spielberg. That's pretty fucking cool.
Mm-hmm.
So they previewed Ready Player One. I don't know if you saw the trailer for that.
I did not, but I know that it's a big fat deal.
Yeah, so it's based on the book,
and I know like Richard read it and had heard about it or something. He liked it.
Yeah, I actually just the trailer was compelling enough to me that I just actually finished Ready Player One.
Cool.
On audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty quick read. But yeah. Just because I was curious as to some of the stuff, because like a big part of it is it's like this virtual reality world, and the maker of it was obsessed with the 80s because that's sort of the era he grew up in.
Sure.
And so that it's like loaded with pop culture references. I mean, the thing they're questing for is called the Easter egg. And so I was just curious as to what you thought, because apparently, again, there's already been some backlash saying that the trailer is too dependent on like pop culture references and people are afraid.
I haven't seen the trailer, so I can't really comment on that.
All I'll say to that is it is part of the story. That's sort of the whole point is. The characters have to navigate all of these pop culture references to find the Easter egg.
Oh my God. The way you're describing it does make me angry, but I'm sure it reads better.
I'm pretty excited for it. I thought it looked pretty cool. Like, it's definitely a movie about pop culture. So,
sure.
We'll see.
And as long as Steven Spielberg and everybody who worked on it is aware of that and it comes off as clever instead of pandering, I'm all for it. Spielberg is certainly a talented guy, but he has made some clunkers kind of recently.
Sure.
Especially when he's working in popcorn mode. He hasn't had a good movie for a while.
I will say he kind of addressed that at the panel. Because
he was just like, who hated Tintin?
Hey, I actually kind of dug Tintin, but no, he was just like, I'm not sure if I'm the one who should direct this. Like, I'm afraid people will too self-serving because a lot of what they're referencing, I was involved in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he had reservations about the script and the book, excited me. I'm super stoked for it. I thought the trailer was awesome, and I dug the book. So,
okay.
Anything
else?
Pretty good. For Ready Player One or for Warner Brothers?
For Comic-Con, the panels.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm just getting started.
Okay.
Let's speed it up. Oh Jesus. They also talked about Blade Runner 2049.
I've seen that trailer a lot.
Yeah, so the only thing I'll say about that is I was a little hesitant about this movie, especially after Alien Covenant.
Mm.
But they, again, we're talking to the director, Denis
Villeneuve.
Denis Villeneuve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And somebody asked him, like, what was Ridley Scott's involvement? And he was... I don't remember the exact phrasing, but somebody asked him a question that was like, you know, why did you agree to do this? And he was like, he said basically something to the effect of, it made his job a lot easier that Ridley Scott was barely involved.
Yikes.
Yeah. I mean, he was pretty blunt about it too. And he's just like, yeah, I wanted to, oh, he said the reason he wanted to do it was because he doesn't want somebody else to fuck it up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's what Zack Snyder said about Watchmen. That's what a lot of people say about their projects that are based on beloved properties.
That's true. But he also did directly address, like, Ridley Scott not looking over his shoulder as a producer, which made me feel a lot better.
I am hearing, I don't know a lot about the movie yet. I mean, based on the trailer, but I am hearing some early Oscar contender buzz for Roger Deakins, the cinematographer, who shockingly has never won a cinematography award from the Academy Awards, which is crazy. But yeah, it looks like it's going to be pretty.
Yeah. Okay. So then the last thing Warner Brothers had was Justice League. That one was really weird because they didn't really show us anything new that they had last year. Like, yeah, it felt like DC was really phoning it in this year, and they had to address the Batman, how Ben Affleck might be leaving Batman rumors, which had leaked, like that news had leaked the day before, and it was real awkward. And
yeah.
Ben Affleck looked pretty haggard. I know there were conflicting reports on what actually happened there. Basically, someone asked him if he was still going to be Batman, and he gave his best, like, Trump totally does not answer the question to answer. It was really awkward.
Which is funny, because all the blogs, the way they put it is Ben's here to stay.
Well, that's like, what I mean. Some of the blogs said Ben's here to stay, and other blogs were like, no, he didn't answer the question. He didn't.
So you're here to confirm. Never said, okay,
he's there to stay. He said, he just talked about how cool it is to be Batman. Not yeah. once did he say, I'm going to be Batman for a while. He's just like, no, it's really cool.
Such an honor, blah, blah, blah.
Like me. So DC was pretty underwhelming this year. All they really released was a few new movie titles. And you know how that is. Those will probably change before they even come out.
Sure. I'm going to predict that Ben Affleck is going to leave. That's my official prediction. It matters.
I 100% think he does. One of the things they released was that the Flash movie will be called Flashpoint. Okay. And based off the comics, I think they're going to write in some opportunities to sort of restructure their DCU. Because the Flashpoint, yeah, I was not excited about this. But the Flashpoint story was how, like, Flash, through time shenanigans, ended up reshaping ended up creating the New 52.
Right. DC it was a universe. Crisis on Infinite reboots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that's kind of what they're going to be doing to their cinematic universe, because everybody's pretty lukewarm about everything but Wonder Woman.
Mm, yeah.
So wasn't super into DC's panel. So yeah, anyway, there was some TV stuff, which I won't really go into. Stranger Things panel, Westworld panel, you know, both were exciting and fun. And then there was the big Marvel panel, of course. There actually wasn't as many movie studios there this year. They didn't preview as much movie stuff.
Minus Ready Player One.
Yeah, well, so Ready Player... Warner Brothers always does a panel, but, like, Fox, all they had was a panel for the new Kingsman movie.
Sure.
And normally they have some other stuff. Lionsgate pulled out a few years ago because of this leaked footage problem. So,
right.
Fucking thanks a lot, nerds.
Well, also now there's like CineCon or whatever. And I feel like a lot of like the movie people are just going to that. And that's like harder to get into. You have to kind of be industry to go to it.
Nobody gives a shit. Never heard of CineCon.
I'm just saying, I think a lot of the movie people are not banking on Comic-Con to be their early buzz anymore. And
well, I think it's mostly because of the leaks.
Yeah.
Anyway, Yeah, but there it was still a good con, because there was a lot of like Netflix stuff that kind of made up for it this year, which was actually kind of more exciting than a lot of the movie stuff usually is, because sometimes the movie stuff is like, oh, you do not know who you're marketing this to, like, like why was there a Black Hat panel at Comic-Con ever? It was fucking weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then there was the big Marvel stuff. They talked a little bit about Captain Marvel. They revealed what Alison Brie's costume is going to look like. Alison Brie? No, Brie Larson.
Brie Larson, yeah. I was like, you're confusing two or three people. Yeah.
Yeah, so they revealed what her costume is going to be like. At least like some sketches of it. They said that this movie is going to take place in the 90s.
I heard that.
It's a prequel. And that the major villains are finally going to be the Skrull. Which leads me to believe, and this is all... So that was all the stuff they really told us. That leads me to believe, this is my spin on it, that post... Infinity War, they're building up to like a Secret Invasion style storyline.
Probably. We went through this online. I'm not a big fan of the Skrull as a villain. In general, I don't like a faceless army of aliens. I mean, Marvel already has a big enough villains problem. But you know, whatever. We'll see.
I was excited.
You can do some interesting kind of like spy, like mole kind of situations with that. Like that's the fun thing about the Skrull, is like anybody can be a Skrull kind of thing. But then also it's like, how bummed are you going to be if you find out like fucking Iron Man has been a Skrull since the first Avengers?
If they had the balls to do that, I'd be sort of impressed. Like if they... start retconning shit like that, I would be like, whoa. Like, you know, it's kind of the same thing as the Mandarin.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's how they'll get out of that pickle. Maybe the real Mandarin's been a Skrull. Who knows? they could go pretty bonkers kooky with it. So I'm kind of curious to see what happens there. I think they could go down some interesting roads. So they talked about that. They announced that Michelle Pfeiffer is going to be in Ant-Man and the Wasp. She's going to be playing the original Wasp, Janet Van Dyne.
Yeah, her name? I don't know, but I'm all for Michelle Pfeiffer and doing anything.
Yeah, and they showed like a fun little sizzle reel for Ant-Man. You know, it looks like it's going to be very similar tonally to the first one. So it's probably going to be kind of a, you know, comedy adventure again. They did that was actually how they kicked off Marvel's panel was, what's his fucking name?
Paul Rudd.
Jesus. And Michael Pena?
Yeah.
So they had them basically recap the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That's fun.
But they, you know, it's very funny. And in like the way of people who would sort of passively pay attention to what's going on.
Right.
So it seems like it's going to be another fun sort of standalone Ant-Man adventure. So I'm excited for that. The footage got me pretty excited. And then they showed us an extended trailer for Thor Ragnarok. So not... They released the trailer online, but there was still stuff cut out of it that we got to see at Comic-Con. So they showed like an extended clip and like a long lead-in to the trailer. But holy shit, I'm so excited for that movie. It looks batshit insane. Like, it is so colorful and otherworldly and weird and really funny.
I'm kind of excited for it. I had no hype. Thor the Dark World is to date my least favorite Marvel movie. But
really? Including The Incredible Hulk?
Yes, even more than that. Really? But
We might have to get into that another time.
But when I had no idea, like, you know, what they were doing with Thor Ragnarok. I know, like, Taika Waititi was doing, and he's cool. But when I saw the trailer, I was like, all right, trailer, you did your job. You made me care about something I absolutely had no hype for.
Yeah. I'm really into it. Mm-hmm. Like, very excited. It seems tonally a lot closer to, like, a Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, that's... well, that could be by design, I'm sure. But...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, I hopefully that reflects in the movie as well.
Yeah. So then they showed also an extended clip and new trailer for Black Panther. None of this has been released online yet.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, you know, kind of the really... one of the really cool things. Very excited for Black Panther as well. It kind of has sort of like an African James Bond vibe going.
What's the actor's name? It's escaping me right now.
Chadwick Boseman.
Chadwick Boseman. He's really good. And he, you know, he got a few scenes in the last Civil War movie. Or the only Civil War movie that they've done. Captain America Civil War. And I really liked what they were doing with him. And he really looked like he was going to, like, have a different kind of mood and presence to the whole thing.
Yeah.
But that story kind of gets lost in the shuffle in Civil War. So I'm really excited to see him, you know, lead a movie.
Yeah. And it just looks also really fucking cool. And very black. Like, you know, but not in a pandering way.
Okay.
Like in a, has a very cool vibe.
Culturally specific.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't think I've seen a superhero movie really try to do before.
At least since Blank Man.
You just like totally... took the air right out of my sails.
It was either that or Meteor Man was going to come out. It was really, it could have been either.
I actually enjoyed both of those movies when I was a kid, and I'm sure they do not hold up at all now. Anyway, very excited for Black Panther as well. Then they still had more footage of the show. They showed the clip of Avengers Infinity War that they showed at
D23. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've read, like, the footage descriptions of that.
No, I don't do that.
It's fucking insane. Like, it was overwhelming. Like, my eyes were starting to water just at, like, the amount of information I was trying to take in. like I don't know if...
Like, you were like Neo in The Matrix, and they're, like, loading in Kung Fu in his brain?
Kind of. That's sort of what it felt like. It was just like unbelievable. And I don't know if they will be able to pull it off as a movie, because there's so much going on. But I could not help but get excited by it.
Right. Right.
Like, there was crazy shit. Like, fucking, when you see Doctor Strange, he's like making these magic platforms and Star-Lord's like jumping off of them, blasting some alien thing, and you're like, what the fuck is going on? I don't know, but it's awesome. And for some reason, Captain America's got a beard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this has nothing to do with anything, but have you heard this whole Superman mustache controversy?
What? No.
So apparently, and maybe I didn't read the articles enough or well enough, so I could be lying completely, but I thought I read somewhere that Henry Cavill had a mustache the whole time they were shooting Justice League for some other movie, and they had to digitally erase it out of the movie. But there's all of this, like, set pictures of him as Superman with this big porn stash, and now there's like this whole like internet meme thing of like, we really want to see that movie with him with the porn stash.
Huh. Okay. I don't know what to... I mean, that sounds fun, but it seems like it'd be distracting.
That whole movie's gonna be a distraction. Who cares?
No one. No, even fucking Warner Brothers doesn't care.
Ben Affleck doesn't care, and he's in it.
Yeah. None of them care. Everyone, even at the panel, everyone was like, can we just, like, skip this and do Wonder Woman 2?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to call that the movie news because we got to move on. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. We're going to review a bunch of movies. We're not going to do the normal Netflix homework, which we were going to do the documentary about the KKK guy that you had me watch. We're going to save that, but we're going to review Okja instead in the Netflix homework. And we are going to talk about Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, which just came out last weekend. And we're going to, I'm going to talk about Valerian right now.
Get to it. What a good tease. I was expecting you to be like, and we're going to talk about Valerian when we come back from these messages.
Yeah. If we had ads, I'd put them right there. Okay, so this is the new film by Luc Besson, French director. I called him a schlockbuster director in my written review. It's called Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. It's based on an old French comic book, also like The Fifth Element, which he directed in the 90s, which is also based on an old French comic book. And both films have been sort of like passion projects for him that he's been trying to get development and money for a really, really long time. I think I heard somewhere this is like the highest budgeted independent film of all time, which I can believe. This is made through his Eurocorp company, where he produces a lot of mostly bad movies, and which I think he made the Arthur and the Invincible movies through. But anyways, so this takes place into the far distant future, where a young space cadet in the military named Valerian, played by Dane DeHaan, is sent on a mission to obtain a rainbow-colored, echidna-looking Pokemon thing that sheds multiples of whatever you feed it, including pearls and diamonds. After he and his partner, Sergeant Loreline, played by, and I always fuck up her name, Cara Delevingne, who was
That's right.
She was in Suicide Squad. She was in the John Green thing. I forgot what it was called already. Paper Towns.
She was also the sorceress bitch in Suicide Squad.
Yeah, I said that.
Oh, did you? Sorry. I was kind of zoning out for a second. I'm not going to lie.
Right. So they're on this mission to find this like weird alien creature from a space gangster, very Jabba the Hutt-like, who's voiced by John Goodman. And so once they grab this, cute little MacGuffin, then they're bounced up, down, and backwards and forwards in this giant city, city-sized planet thing that holds all of these little sections that belong to different cultures. That's why it's called City of a Thousand Planets. And then it's pretty much just kind of a...
My real question is...
Yeah?
How many of these thousand planets do we get to see?
Like six. Five or six.
Could have they just called it Valerian and the like kind of six planets?
I mean, you're led to believe that there's a lot of it we're not seeing. There's a lot of scenes where... Like, remember that part in the last Guardians of the Galaxy where they're like zipping through the galaxy really fast because they're like using this weird time warpy thing?
Yeah.
So there's something kind of like that in this movie they're using all this technology where you see different little bits of alien cultures for like a second, but it's not really a full blown scene.
Are there a thousand of them?
I don't know. I didn't count.
Because it goes right back to when we watched Split. And he had, like, the fucking 29 personalities, and we saw 8.
Primarily, yeah.
If you can't give us 1,000 planets, don't promise us 1,000 fucking planets.
What we end up finding throughout the movie is that this whole mission for them to bring this thing back to the military is actually part of a larger cover-up where the military fucked something up a long time ago. This isn't a spoiler. This is literally in the first scene of the movie where there was a bunch of casualties where they accidentally destroyed a peaceful, oceanic planet of this peaceful race, and now they're kind of being kept a secret and hidden and imprisoned on this planet, and they're trying to get out. So this is full of a lot of like crazy Luc Bessonian campiness. A lot of people who went into this movie, myself included, was kind of hoping that this would sort of be Fifth Element 2 unofficially, or a spiritual successor to it. And there is a decent amount of that. It definitely has that whole everything in the kitchen sink more is more approach to it, especially aesthetically. Everybody, you know, it has this kind of crazy sort of Mylar disco, Barbarella crazy psychedelic look to the whole movie.
That was a lot of adjectives.
Yes. And well, it's there's a lot to use in this movie. Actually, the best segment of the movie, because it's pretty, once they start going from culture to culture and they're just trying to like get back to their base, it's pretty episodic. It's just about them really just sort of going from set piece to set piece. The best section for the movie, in my mind, is when they run into a burlesque dancing jellyfish person who can transform into whatever she wants, played by Rihanna, who has a intergalactic pimp, played by Ethan Hawke. And
that would have been a good opportunity for like a weird callback to have like Ruby Rod or something.
Well, it's very of that. Like, Ian, if that's the thing you're hoping to see, that is the closest you get to it. Also, that okay. scene in the opera, the blue thing with the giant tentacles yeah. on her head, very similar. Like a very similar kind of opera. Like a cinematic transcendent moment where Rihanna gets to do a dance and be Rihanna and a jellyfish at the same time. That stuff is a lot of fun. The look of the movie is a lot of fun. The joy and the exuberance of the movie and sort of the candy high quality of it, a lot of fun. The plot, not so much. The characters, even less so. The big problem with this movie is the casting, I'm going to say. Valerian, played by Dane DeHaan, and Loreline, Cara Delevingne. They're supposed to have this sort of Han Solo, Princess Leia, like, will they, won't they, sort of, like, banter back and forth. Mm-hmm. They have absolutely no chemistry. They might as well be cousins. And Dane DeHaan is completely miscast because he's supposed, you know, like a sort of cocky flyboy yeah. in the same way of, like, Han Solo. He's not pulling it off. It's just totally the wrong role for him.
I don't think Hollywood knows what to do with Dane DeHaan.
I know, and he's a really talented actor. What they need to think he's more like a young DiCaprio. He's sort of brooding. He's sort of introverted, and so it doesn't work here. Cara Delevingne, I have yet to see her be really great in anything. Yeah. However, I did see an interview with her later, where she has a shaved head, and she's actually British, so she was speaking with this thick British accent, and she had a ton of sass in the interview. I wish it would have ended up in the movie. I wish she really got to like just be herself and keep her accent, and maybe the shaved head. But in this movie, she's totally flat, totally not doing anything. She's supposed to be kind of like ditzy smart, where she says like things like, oh, that's a, you know, I wish we could go shopping or whatever. But she's also supposed to be like really strong and like, you know, be able to take down like a whole like hallway of guards or whatever by yourself. But neither of them are terribly believable in their parts, and the romance that they're supposed to be flirting with throughout the movie doesn't take off ever. And ultimately, the rest of the movie, as cool as it looks, is just kind of aesthetic wallpaper. So by the time you get to the, I guess, what's supposed to be the thematic and emotional payoffs of the movie in the last third, you're not really invested in either of those things. So ultimately, it doesn't really work. But I will say, I think the movie has a little bit of a cult appeal in the same way that like Ice Pirates had, or like Adventures in Babysitting.
All right. I mean, that was kind of all I was hoping for with that movie. Like, I don't know. When it got pretty bad reviews right out of the gate, I didn't have high hopes.
It's neither. I saw mixed reviews, and it was very one or the other. Like, people are like, this is everything I've ever wanted in cinema, or this was a, you know, complete abortion. It's neither. It's just sort of an ineffective blockbuster, but it has enough idiosyncrasies, the Luc Besson-ian idiosyncrasies, that makes it worth seeing on Netflix later.
Okay. That's when I'll see it then.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's move on to the big one, the big dog.
Dunkirk.
Big dog, Dunkirk.
Which I just saw today.
Saw it like Sunday.
There's a lot to digest for a same day review. So I'm going to let you set this up. What's going on in this movie?
There's not that much to set up. So this is from writer-director Christopher Nolan. This is a Christopher Nolan joint.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, I'm reading on Netflix now. It was World War II. I couldn't decide which World War it was.
Yes. They mentioned Churchill a few times.
Yeah, I don't know how old that dude is, though. Because, I mean, he was really old coming out of World War II, so it could have been entirely possible that, I don't know. I'm not a history guy. come at me, Patrick, from Almost Educational. Anyway, that's my American education for you. So this is about a group of British soldiers. I think it's like 400,000 soldiers that are stuck at Dunkirk, this beach city. They're surrounded by the enemy, the Axis parties. I don't think America had entered the war yet. So they're there with a bunch of French. Nobody gives a fuck about the French. It's a very British movie. And it's about them just escaping Dunkirk. And there's sort of three separate stories going on. There's this like young soldier on the beach. Mm-hmm. Then there's this civilian boat that is sailing to Dunkirk because...
On a rescue mission.
Yeah, because Churchill pulled out the rest of the rescue ships because they were all getting sunk. They were just kind of sitting targets for the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically they were leaving like 400,000 soldiers to die, cutting their losses. So a whole bunch of civilian ships get enlisted and sail off to Dunkirk. And the second story is about one of those ships. And then the third story is Tom Hardy grunting in an airplane.
Right. So it's, and I think they title it this way. It's Land, Sea, and Air.
Yeah. And they all take place over different amounts of time.
Uh-huh.
So the first story takes place over a week. The second story takes place over a day. And the third story takes place over an hour. And they all get sort of connected at various points.
Yeah, the movie is constantly sort of shuffling or cross-cutting between these three situations.
Yeah.
That are different temporally.
Yes. I think that's all there is to recap, because the story isn't, it's not like very plot-heavy. Like I said, it's mostly just about these people trying to leave this forsaken beach city.
Right. It's a war movie, but it's also sort of a survival story as well, about how long you can kind of stay in this volatile situation.
Yeah. How did you feel about Dunkirk?
I have a lot of mixed emotions here. And like I said, I'm very fresh off of this. This is probably one I should have had a week or more to really kind of sink in, or at least a few days.
Yeah, I have had a few days, but I still kind of have some mixed emotions about it, actually.
Yeah, I think that this is, you know, it's speaking of reviews, this is getting incredibly good reviews, especially by people who are not, like, of that sort of Batman fanboy Nolan kind of hype world. This is his, like, quote-unquote, his grown-up movie, or is that's what it's sort of being touted as.
Because this is the first one that is... I would say it's not a genre picture, but it totally is, because war movie is a genre. It's just
right, but it's not part of like sort of the Comic-Con crowd. It's not part of the fanboy world.
Well, yeah, it's a genre that that people can critically appraise and not be laughed at for.
Right, right.
I have kind of a weird beef against like war movies and the way they get reviewed.
No, that's totally fair. I think there is something to be said about that. And I think, you know, generally speaking, war movies is not my genre. I don't hate them or like say Westerns or musicals or a lot of the more classical genres. I don't hate them, but I will say that they have a higher bar for me to impress me, because it's just, you know, like I've always said, I would rather see a bad horror movie than like a mediocre to good war movie.
Okay.
Just from where my vantage point of just, you know, preferences. But, I, you know, one thing I notice, a couple things I notice where Christopher Nolan is challenging himself and trying something he doesn't always do is I've always thought of Christopher Nolan as being much more of a big picture guy. So a lot of his movies, and I think I maybe mentioned this recently, kind of get knocked for being cold or clinical. And he rarely goes into scene. He's often really playing into like the larger aspect of the mechanics of the plot, these puzzle box narratives that he likes to build. And this has, with the editing, has a little bit of that, maybe more than I would have liked. But I think that, you know, he does a really good job at like getting in there and like being in the scene and being in the moment. The very first scene is a really great tracking shot that is very intense and very grounded, very handheld, which we haven't seen from him, like that kind of handheld work since the Memento days. And a lot of the beach stuff is really exciting. Hoyt Van Hoytima, I might be getting that name wrong, is the cinematographer here. And it looks great. I think this is definitely going to, again, alongside maybe, Blade Runner is going to get some mentions for cinematography.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, honestly, maybe this sounds cynical, and this might sort of shed light on how I felt about the movie. But it feels like Nolan's like, damn it, I want an Oscar. Why don't I have an Oscar? It feels kind of Oscar pushy to me. And I think it will probably get nominated for some stuff. Definitely, the cinematography was absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, there's a lot of picturesque moments in this movie. I thought that Wally Pfister come back because a lot of that stuff had that same kind of cool blue hue that like the Batman movies had, or specifically Dark Knight. But yeah, anyway, so like, you know, the big picture, he's getting a little better about getting into scene and like actually being there with his characters. The problem is that a lot of these characters, we're not there with them for very long before we're shuffling to another thing. And they're always in such a crisis mode that you don't get like that moment in Jaws where Quinn is telling his story, you know, about the Indianapolis. You don't get those kind of moments where we really get to know these characters. And a lot of them look really similar. And I had a hard time connecting to the movie as a story. More than just like a series of really exciting and really kind of, seat-clenching action scenes.
So that sort of brings me to my biggest criticism. Because I didn't hate this movie. I didn't think it was like bad or anything. But it is, to me, the movie feels like one big action scene.
Yeah.
Like it starts with high intense action and literally never lets up, to the point where I think it's problematic, because there's no moment where you can sort of rest from the tension, that you're automatically put back in crisis mode. There's no build up to any, which is frustrating to me because I think there are moments that could have emotionally paid off a lot more had they just sort of played with the pacing a little bit in the editing, because it's it's literally just to the point where I got kind of numb to it, and I was like, okay, just like let them die if they're gonna die. And I don't know, maybe that is cynical, and I think and I was talking to my wife about it. And she's like, well, you know, that's what war is. Like that, I think that was intentional to sort of give you that discomfort of being like across enemy lines, you know, and I get that. And I do think that's valid, but I think that's where this big picture you're talking about with Christopher Nolan comes in. And ultimately, I think it kind of, a lot of stuff didn't play for me as I think it could have. It had just like some of the action been broken up a little bit with some just like you said, some slow moments, some moments to just like, okay, why do we even care if these kids get back home? You know, like So that was sort of frustrating to me. I felt like this was on the cusp of being really cool, but it was just sort of... It was Nolan experimenting with a giant budget, which is cool to see. Like, that is interesting, because you don't see a lot of directors who get to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I feel like maybe this shouldn't have been the final cut, if that makes sense.
Well, it's a very lean movie. It's, you know, this is one of his shortest movies, I think, in a while. It's an hour 40-something minutes. So we're not even...
It's not even the runtime is what's bothering me. Like, what's bothering me is the complete lack of levels.
Right. Well, that's kind of what I'm talking about. I feel like the movie's been sort of hyper-compressed, like, in the editing, because I don't know if the plan was always to shuffle these scenes the way he does. Yeah. I feel like that might have been a later decision, because some of these juxtapositions don't really help the pacing all that well.
No, in fact, some of them, I think, confused me. Like, straight up, I was like, wait, how are these characters interacting? If you know, I was
we're shifting from night scenes into the next scene, which is a day scene, and then back to a night scene. I was getting confused because I thought we were temporarily on the same day or time, and then I realized like what was actually going on and when the stories are going to come together, and I'm like, ah, the puzzle box, here it is.
I think that did just kind of confuse things in a way, right, that if they had just taken more time with each individual story, mm-hmm, and like still you could still cross cut them, mm-hmm, but some of the cuts were so short that I felt like the scenes didn't get to breathe at all.
Right.
I think sort of the opposite effect of like what happened with Interstellar. It was so cross-cut.
It was, yeah. Interstellar kind of gets that way towards the end, and I think the success of how that sort of cross-cutting works in Inception maybe taught Nolan the wrong lessons. Well, he's always been very formally interested, all the way back to Memento, which is, and even following his, like, no-budget black-and-white film is temporally all over the place, too, but in a more effective way. I get what you mean here. I think there's, a lot of later Nolan films, I think, since he's been, you know, making high-budget art films, I'm a lot more impressed with the filmmaking than I am with the storytelling.
Yes, I agree with that. And it's sort of frustrating to me because I do feel like, I don't know, of the two of us, I've sort of been a Nolan apologist for the last few movies. Mm-hmm. And this one, I'm kind of like, I see what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, personally, I would say, even though it's not as like up my alley genre-wise, and I kind of left going like, all right, I'll probably never see that again. I probably would say successful than the last two, just as being a movie-going experience.
Oh, I wouldn't say this as compared to Inception?
No. Compared to Interstellar and the last Batman film that he did.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was like,
I think it's more structurally sound than either of those. It feels a little less slapdash. It feels like it's coming from a more sincere and impassioned place, and more specific, because it goes into like his British culture, which he doesn't, you know, with the exception of Michael Caine, doesn't really go into all that much with his movies. It took way too long for me to care about what was going on, to understand what was going on, and to B, care about it. And then by the third act, when I kind of was in the movie's rhythm and I was like, okay, I'm here now, and then it kind of ends.
Yeah. Quick sidebar. I do think it's kind of fun to see him embracing his British heritage.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know he has a brother. He actually has two brothers.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is one of the creators of Westworld, the TV show.
Sure, yeah, that's Jonathan Nolan.
Yes,
and which was one of his biggest co-writers for a long part of his career. I think up until Inception.
And he has no accent.
He's from Chicago. Well, he moved to Chicago when he was younger.
Yeah, and he purposely shook his accent. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is just a fun little Nolan sidebar. And apparently, their third brother's in jail. But yeah, so Dunkirk, I do think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. Mm-hmm. I will say that. Ultimately, I think the second story was the most compelling, the one about the boat.
And agreed,
I wanted to see... I wanted that story to have a little more room to breathe. I think the other two stories could have been... could have kept that pacing and that intensity if they had let that story breathe. But also... I want to say the score is, I think it's by Hans Zimmer again, is like oppressive.
Agreed. It's very insistent. And I think the score along with the editing in tandem is what's kind of making the movie so, like, I know that they're trying to always keep the tension up, but there's a lot of scenes that actually would have played more like breathers, would have played more like kind of. If there wasn't this insistent, like, ratcheting up, you know, noisy thing in the background that's keeping the tension at an 11 the entire time.
Yeah, and I agree. I think with a little bit different editing and the score should have been a little bit different too. I think it could have been a lot more engaging because I feel like that's the story about the boat. Had a lot of meat to it that felt like it just got rushed, and I was pretty disappointed by that. But I do think, as far as a war movie goes, this is definitely an interesting approach because it's not really a war. It's like you said, it's more of a survival movie than a war movie.
Right.
I don't think, other than Tom Hardy and his plane, I don't think we ever see a main character shoot once or resort to any kind of violence, which to me was...
There's a couple scenes where the soldiers have to shoot back or attempt to when they're running, but yeah, it's not like a storming of Normandy kind of experience.
I guess what I mean is it was a lot less violent than I was expecting.
Yeah,
which is sort of an inch. It's all of the violence, not all of it. Most of it is implied. Which I thought, which did work for me. That I thought was a pretty cool approach. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a sort of guts and glory Saving Private Ryan, you know, like really viscerally violent war movie. So that I thought, I think it was an interesting approach. I think all the actors are really good. What's his name? The boat captain. In particular, stood out with Mark Rylance.
Yeah,
who that was?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of people in this movie, and we haven't named almost any of them. I mean, Tom Hardy was in it.
No.
Cillian Murphy's in there. There's a isn't it one of the One Direction
Cillian
kids?
Murphy was really good. Huh?
Yeah, but didn't have a lot to do. Like that, I felt he was a little wasted.
That's what I mean. That's what's frustrating is because there was meat there. So basically, to sum up, I think Dunkirk, I do think it was a good movie. I think the editing and the score kind of spoiled it. I think it could have been a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were really into war movies, like this is your bread and butter. Like if you're one of those people for whom, you know, Saving Private Ryan and like Black Hawk Down is in your top five, you're gonna love this movie. But if this isn't your norm, if this isn't your normal patois, I don't think it's gonna convert you. I think it's a too problematic story wise for it to, I don't know, totally connect. However, people do seem to be responding to the movie more than it does to us, so it's a little hard to tell at this point, but I think it's a little minor.
Yeah, I would agree. I do want to watch it again, though. I will say that, like, after I watched it, I was like, I feel like I missed stuff that could have, I don't know. So I would watch it again. It was lean enough to where I wouldn't mind investing my time in it again, but it's fine. I don't... letter grade.
Like a B- for me.
Yeah. I think I'm about the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go ahead and get into Bong Joon-ho's Okja, which was a direct Netflix release, but did have a little bit of a theatrical release as well. I know here at the New Beverly, they printed a special 35mm version of it, since the Beverly has a film-only rule, so that they could show Okja for a few screenings.
Okja.
Okja, yes.
You say it like such a Westerner.
So this is, like I said, this is directed by the South Korean director Bong Joon-ho, who also made Snowpiercer and The Host.
Joon-ho Bong.
That's how it's said on IMDb, but I had an actual South Korean teacher, and she said it as Bong Joon-ho.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I actually kind of sort of helped her do a book on him, but anyway. I was a research assistant, but anyway, so this takes place, I guess, sort of in the future, or sort of a fictitious present, in which a giant global super corporation food organization called Mirando.
Yes,
which is an obvious kind of stand-in for Monsanto. Is genetically engineering super pigs, these giant Eeyore-looking cute floppy-eared things, to create a new, they're calling genetically pure or non-modified, GMO-free meat out there.
Yeah, it's a super pig designed to end world hunger.
Yes.
It's meant to... It's sort of an alternate present
satire kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this super pig is meant to end world hunger, so they do this super pig competition where all these different farmers have to raise these pigs from little piglets.
Mm-hmm.
Then at the end of the competition, the largest one gets named the best pig. Presumably will get eaten.
right. Tilda Swinton plays Lucy Mirando. She's the head of this corporation and really pushing this kind of clean energy, clean food production sort of marketing presentation about all of this. And she brings on board a famous TV personality named Johnny Wilcox, a sort of Steve Irwin-ish, guy.
Almost like Steve Irwin meets the dude from Blue's Clues.
Yeah. Jake Gyllenhaal is playing this part. Basically, the story centers around a young girl in South Korea who lives in the hills of South Korea, who's been raising this giant pig, and her grandfather never told her that eventually this thing has to go away and, be turned into food. So they've built a relationship, and it's super cute and super adorable until Lucy Mirando and Jake Gyllenhaal, who actually his character does have a name, but I'm not seeing it, Johnny Wilcox, come to go take this pig away, at which point they get caught up in this whole whirlwind adventure of trying to rescue the pig with an activist organization, a sort of PETA-ish activist organization led by Paul Dano, being weird Paul Dano. The adventures that ensue within this plan to get Okja back to South Korea. Okja. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, if you look at Bong Joon-ho's work over, at least through his last few films, where he really, really tackled genre filmmaking in a big way, specifically sort of science fiction and monster movies with The Host and with this film and Snowpiercer even, he's a very satirical guy. And all three films are extremely political. And are talking a lot about globalization and talking a lot about the corporatism and how that.
I need to rewatch The Host.
You should. It's a good movie.
Yeah. I remember the first time I saw it, and I think I did not see it in the right setting, but I want to rewatch that one anyway.
And I think, all three movies really, but I think this and The Host are the most kind of spiritually linked. Although there's a lot of the same messages that are in the in Snowpiercer as well, especially when you're talking about sort of the food manufacturing and keeping people in the dark and, you know, government overreach and all of these things. It plays heavily into this movie. But I think he's really, really good at balancing the ideas, you know, the big picture stuff, if we're talking about that again, with the emotional beats and with the character-oriented stuff.
Exactly. He's very good at bringing it to a personal level. And especially with the, I think with the girl in this one is like, you just relate to her so bad. Like anyone who's had a pet, I think, you know, this is sort of like the 2017 modern day, Charlotte's Web kind of thing going on here.
I was going to say Pete's Dragon. I was, I mean, I know they remade that recently, and I guess it kind of got good reviews. But that first, the first third of the movie, when we see Misha with Oakja out in the woods, kind of bouncing around and being happy, I was reminded a lot of sort of the warmth of a Pete's Dragon.
I get that, but it. The sort of the threat to Oakja reminded me a lot of like Babe and Charlotte's Web and, you know, and not just because it's a pig. But
funny enough, the Beverly actually showed Oakja in a double screening with Babe Pig in the City.
Yeah, I can see it. Wait, is that the sequel?
Yeah.
I never saw that one, but I guess that'll do, Pig. Yeah, I don't know. So how did you feel about Oakja?
I really like this movie. It's batshit crazy, and I think, you know, it's tonally, I don't want to say difficult because I think it's all very intentional, but it's tonally difficult in ways that I don't think American film watchers are going to completely understand, because there are segments of it that do feel kind of like a kid's movie, but then it is an R-rated film, and it does,
and there's some horrifying imagery in this,
and it gets really fucked up at times for sure, but then it's also very satirical and very smart and talking about very adult oriented themes. But then you also have this like batshit crazy, very arch performances from Tilda Swinton and Jake Gyllenhaal. Gyllenhaal's playing his character like if Jim Carrey were doing an impression of like Rip Taylor or something.
See, that's funny. That is a pretty good pull. I thought it was like if Bubble Boy had grown up and gotten his own like Animal Planet show.
I mean, it's big. It's very, very big.
At times, I will say, he was like sort of the closest thing to a sore thumb for me in this movie. I was like, I sort of couldn't handle his character, but I also understand that is sort of the purpose of that character.
Right.
Like, I think it's definitely intentional how gigantic and broad he's playing it.
Yeah.
And I think he's
committed.
Yeah. And he's a damn fine actor, but it to the point where it's like grating to the nerves.
Right. Yeah. And Tilda Swinton, we've seen her do so many things. You just accept anything now. Yeah. I mean, she's just a consummate professional, and her and Bong Joon-ho have like a shorthand, obviously. And she's allowed to just kind of,
she's just delightful.
She's the best.
Totally camps it up, but in a very like real way. Even Paul Dano is cast, I think, really well, because you kind of never know what's going on with his character. Like, is he genuine, or is he going to fuck everybody over? Like, right. Is he a weirdo?
Well, I think that Bong Joon-ho, intentionally or not, I'm not sure, but I think that casting of Paul Dano, who normally plays these kind of introverted weirdos, it's kind of used comedically in some scenes where they almost are sort of like making fun of his stereotype as an actor. Like the scene where he like is sneaking into the hotel room and like just pops out of a curtain. Like that was, you know, there's a lot of intentional humor here that really works.
Also, this movie's fucking hard to watch at times too. Mm-hmm. Like there's some pretty nightmarish imagery at the end that it's genuinely making me and my wife consider at least cutting beef out of our diet.
Yeah, I've heard some people say that if there's a movie that's going to turn you vegan, it's going to be this one.
Yeah,
which is funny because they had to invent a creature that doesn't already exist to do that.
Well, I mean, you couldn't show some of this stuff happening to a real animal safely.
Right.
The fact that it is a CGI animal, I think, helps them sort of be more real, if that makes sense. It's sort of more human than human kind of thing going on. Yeah, and, you know, like, I think all the documentaries and stuff can't capture the horror the way this movie does because it has that human connection. It has the storyline go with it. So it's not just like a documentary where people are like, this is what we do to cows and it's really fucked up and sad. Mm-hmm. It's like you see it from this cipher and it's told in a story that's going to emotionally resonate a lot more than just sort of having people spout facts at you.
For sure. Did you find the movie to be didactic or too on the nose at any point? Or do you think that it was that it, as far as its messaging goes, it balanced that well enough with story to never feel too messagey?
That is such a leading question. But yeah, I felt like it worked. It always felt like the lens of satire to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it never... I think satire can do that. It can come right at you with what it's intending. And I think the emotional connection is real enough that I never really felt that. It was pretty engrossed in the story the whole time.
Right.
That the stuff that was horrifying was just horrifying. It wasn't like, okay, we get it, Okja.
Yeah.
It never felt preachy to me.
Okay. Okay. Because I think some might feel that way, especially if you are a diehard meat eater. And I'm, you know, fairly carnivorous. But yeah, you know, I think the messaging worked for me. More so than just like meat is murder. I along with the host and Snowpiercer, I found its sort of anti-corporate message overarching very effective.
Here's the thing. I don't think the movie was ever out to say, meat is murder. If you eat meat, you're a bad person.
Yeah, because they turned the PETA-ish group, I forget what their name is called in this, ATL or something like that.
Yeah.
They turned them almost kind of satirical, too. Like, they're played sort of as a joke.
Exactly. And there are some characters there that have some less than honorable intentions as well. Mm-hmm. So there are some twists and turns that I don't want to get into too much.
I would compare it a little bit, not totally, but a little bit to that movie Citizen Ruth that... Laura Dern was in it, but I forget who the director was. The guy who made Sideways and...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was his first movie, and it was about the issue of abortion and about the two factions and this crazy woman that Laura Dern plays is sort of stuck in the middle of this of the war.
Gotcha.
But it's I think a slightly more successful version of that movie, but similar in its thematics.
Yeah, I think that it is. It wasn't ever the fact that it's like, oh, if you eat meat, you're awful. It's more like how they hide how cruel it actually can be. And just sort of, I think it's more making the argument of like, we got to change the way we do this versus you shouldn't eat meat ever. I mean, I can see how people got that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the movie's trying to make an argument as far as that. I think it's more like let's look at how we're doing things.
Yeah, it's more about the mass production of it and sort of the
I think
cold bottom line calculation of of the execution of these giant corporate feeding entities.
And torture too. It just shows like how inhumane both people and animals are to these corporations, because they only care about the bottom line. Mm. It's more about that to me than anything else. You know, and animal cruelty just happens to be sort of the centerpiece of that. So to me, I think it also doesn't really offer a solution to the problem. Points out
what's
they
the problem.
Sort of see as as the problem and what's happening. So so I wouldn't say, you know, you have to go vegan after this, but you know, I think maybe it is worth looking at the cattle industry and the pork industry, you know, like, because it's something I really don't know a whole lot about. And
well, that's something that we purposely don't think about. I think everyone sort of intuitively knows that, yes, these creatures are being, like, you know, bred for death, and then they're being stuck in these tiny kennels and being, you know, mutated with all these crazy genes, and then being shot in the head and chopped in half and served on a plate somewhere. Like, and we know that, but we don't, we try very hard, and in some cases very easily, try and forget those things.
Yes. And I will say, you know, there, I think there is also an element to the fact that Oakjaw is a fictitious super pig that's very intelligent and very emotionally intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not making the case that this is what a cow goes through, this is what pigs go through. Again, it's more about just how the industry doesn't give a fuck about anybody. Uh-huh. And you get that with Jake Gyllenhaal's character, you get that with fucking, what's her name?
Tilda character. Swinton.
Tilda Swinton, yeah. Mm. So to me, that's more the through line. It's just how these institutions don't care about people.
Sure. And also, it's very funny, it's very satirical, it's very smart, it's all these things. I think it's also, there's some really great action set pieces in this. I totally buy Oakjaw as a CGI creature in a way that I didn't always in The Host. I think it works better here. There's a scene in the beginning of the movie where they're like sliding down this cliff and like Oakjaw has to make these quick decisions. I was more thrilled by that scene than anything in Dunkirk.
Yeah. No, I would agree actually. And that's such a good scene too, because it establishes the bond between Oakjaw and the girl who can't remember her name.
Misha? Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a, I thought this movie, was a delightful tearjerker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is, no bones about it, though. There are parts that are fucking hard to watch that, will upset you unless you are a sociopath.
Maybe, yeah.
I think this movie could be the sociopath test. Like, if at the end of it, you're like, oh, let's see what the problem is, and eat, like, a big old jerky. You're just like, yeah, what's the, yeah. No, it was a good movie. It was fun. It was a fun pig.
I didn't cry or anything, but I did, the movie worked for me on all, emotionally, and I had a lot
it's
of-
It's okay to say you felt.
I did feel. I thought it was good. I really like this movie, and I'm a big fan of this director.
God, you're gonna kill your next Uber driver and keep them under the floorboards of your room.
Did you cry? Did you actually cry?
I mean, I don't cry at anything, but I definitely got teared up.
Okay.
Like, to me, that's the same as crying.
All right.
Like, I don't get tears streaming down my face, but I get choked up.
Mm-hmm.
I get to that point where if I talk, I'll definitely cry. and I was there for this.
Yeah, if I get the lump in my throat or whatever, then I know that, like, oh, okay, this is having some sort of effect on me.
And, oh, yes, I'm still human. Oh, good, that programming has not completely taken over. I feel...
All right. Well, that's the show. And next week, we're still going to review for the Netflix homework, Accidental Courtesy, the documentary that you assigned me the last time we did an episode. I've seen it. You haven't. We're going to get to it. And if anybody has anything to say about anything we've talked about in this episode, you can get in contact with us on our email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com or on Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. I am individually on Twitter at BC Cassidy, and you are on Twitter where?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Also check out my show Tonight in San Diego. Go to tonightinsandiego.com if you want to get tickets to the live taping. We give prizes away and all sorts of cool stuff happens. We, speaking of animals, we recently had wolf puppies on the show. Tonight in San Diego at Keith Foster Kid.
You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I just recently uploaded a bunch that I've kind of been lazy about getting on the internet over the summer. I'm about to load up my Valerian review and going to write my Dunkirk review either tonight or tomorrow. And we have friends who also do podcasts that you should be listening to, including the previously mentioned Patrick at Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational.
He also said on his show, Make Dad Read Comics, he wants to have me as a guest sometime.
Yes.
Literally anytime. Let's do it.
You need to get a DM going on Twitter.
I think it'll be more just cool to have like coded messages throughout all of the podcasts. We've actually been J.J. Abramsing this. we actually have the episode done and wrapped and set to release at a future date that if you can crack the code, that'll be a lot of fun for you.
I believe it. And check out Ron Denise at The Listening Party. They just released their last episode all about heat, which I'm feeling right now. I am drenched in my own body sweat.
Yeah.
And, Mascot Diaries, Denise's solo podcast in which she interviews famous and not so famous mascots all over the country. Do you have anything else to promote? Didn't you have like friends who did a Hearthstone or something?
Yeah, I think it's blizzlet.com. I can't remember. Sorry, guys. I'll plug it next time.
I think that was maybe it. Okay, so that's the show. Talk to you later.
Bye.
No sign off?
Oh, yeah. And if people followed me on Twitter and Instagram, they might have seen that in Hall H on Saturday, I gave it to Gosling.
Bye.